So again, this morning the class is on King Solomon. We did a class last week on David. Let me see if I can get this. And so this week it's Solomon. Next week Alan will be back, and he's going to talk about Solomon's successors and what happened to the kingdom after Solomon's reign. Even though you'll get a little bit of a clue today about what happens, because that was part of Solomon's story. Some ways Solomon had more of to do with the story than the subsequent kings or his son. But Jesus referred, when in his teachings, there's not a lot of references to Solomon in the New Testament. There's some location where they met was Solomon's colonnade. But Jesus referred to Solomon, and the thing that he was teaching him about was he talked about Solomon's splendor. So when we all think about Solomon from our Sunday school growing up, you know, you do the curse, you know, just kind of a surface study, your initial reaction is, and your initial thought about Solomon is, there was a lot of splendor in his reign. He's the acknowledged author, or maybe compiler, of the book of Proverbs, also Ecclesiastes, and then a book called The Song of Solomon. And, you know, very obviously, it reflects that he had, also the other thing he was known for was an incredible amount of wisdom. So it'll be interesting to see that in many ways, he, I would say, glaringly failed to live up to the teachings in some of these works. Or you read them and you say, so how did the guy wind up the way he did? Based on what you read about his wisdom. But we're going to talk about that. So to start off, I want to do kind of... Maybe I got this. Here we go. I think I have it turned on. I should have tested it before. Hey, maybe the battery's a little... Okay, thank you. I guess sometimes you turn the batteries like this. Have you ever done that? When you're remote control? Maybe they pushed it up there in the control room and I didn't know it. But anyway, here we are. The synopsis that I want to go over today for Solomon is chapters 1 and 2. And again, this comes from the book of 1 Kings. And Solomon covers chapters 1 through 11, almost talk exclusively about Solomon's reign in Jerusalem. So chapters 1 and 2 talk about the transition of the rule from David to Solomon. Chapters 3 and 4... Solomon's administration of the kingdom, as I summarized it here. Larry's coming to rescue me. Chapters 5 and through 8 is building of the temple and then the palace that he lived in. And then 9 and 10, thank you, is an overview of Solomon's legacy. Obviously, we're not going to be able to cover all the nuances of these 11 chapters in 40 minutes. So like last week, we're going to focus on the nature of his reign in the context of his obedience to God's law. And there's a lot to talk about. So if you have your Bibles, turn to 1 Kings chapter 1. Strange, isn't it? Yeah. Well, maybe y'all could do it. Were you advancing that, or did he advance it? Because it started. Okay. We'll just push it back to chapters. Was he moving it? It's hard to tell if he's moving or. Okay, I'm going to do it. Okay, I did it. I think it's back online. Yep. All right. Thank you. He's great. All right, guys, thank you for your patience, technical. First, we're going to start reading in verse 5 of 1 Kings chapter 1. Now, Adonijah, whose mother was Haggith, put himself forward and said, I will be king. So he got chariots and horses ready with 50 men to run ahead of him. His father had never rebuked him or confronted him by asking, why do you behave as you do? He was also very handsome and was born next after Absalom. Adonijah conferred with Joab, son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar the priest, and they gave him their support. But Zadok the priest, Benaiah son of Jehoiada, Nathan the prophet, Shimei, and Rei, and David's special guard did not join Adonijah. So what we're going to talk about is the story starts here with the first couple of verses, which I didn't read, talk about a young maiden named Abishag. And it seemed, and when you first read it, it's like, that's curious as to why that's in there, because it just talks about how she served as, I guess, for lack of a better word, a warming blanket for King David, because he had chill. So there's implication that tied her very, I guess the relationship was so, was this special role that she had. I don't know how many of you would like your daughters, what does your daughter do? Well, my daughter lays in bed with the king and keeps him warm. That wouldn't be necessarily the most interesting job to have. We'll talk about women toward the end because I have a comment about it. But it's kind of a curious story. It's in there. We're going to come to it in a minute. It has some relevance. I think the reason it's in there is later on in terms of the relationship, the rivalry between Adonijah and Solomon. So she was in there. She became closely associated with King David. But the story we're going to look at is Adonijah sets himself up. And again, this is going to carry over from our class from last week, just in this brief observation I want to make about David. Because one thing we talked about last week was, or one thing that I put forward to you, was the notion that David had his sin with Bathsheba, and he repented, and he acknowledged it, and he was confronted with it, and dealt with it, I believe, in a way that pleased God. But I think also, there was the stories that followed, and these tragic family situations that he had possibly reflected, maybe a paralysis on his part almost, where he didn't really confront his children, it seemed, in terms of how they behaved, and then more tragedies happened. Amnon, and we talked about Amnon and Absalom last week, and ended up in the death of both. Both those sons died, as it turned out, violent deaths. Maybe, fulfillment of God's curse to David for his sin was the sword will never leave your family. Well, this story kind of completes the circle between Adonijah and Solomon, because Adonijah comes up and says, I'm king. And, the reason that I put that forward is verse 6. It says his father had never rebuked him, never confronted him in some passages about what he did. David had a plan. Maybe David never talked to Adonijah and said, hey, I've got to have a difficult talk. Solomon's going to be the one that I anoint to be king, even though I know you're older. That would have been a difficult conversation to have. It seems like he never had it. Or if he did, he did not do it very confrontationally. So Adonijah sets himself up as king and divides the court. I want you to note that Joab sided with, who is David's chief military person, sided with Adonijah in this rivalry. So he has, Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, goes and approaches the king and says, he has invited everybody but Solomon. So he kind of knows, Adonijah almost knows who he thinks the successor is going to be, but he sets himself up as the king. Bathsheba goes to David with the advisors that did not side with Adonijah, and David has to make a decision and lay out and basically humiliate in front of everybody his son Adonijah by saying, here's who I've decided Solomon's going to be king. So Adonijah goes into the altar, grabs the horns of the altar, which basically is a sign of asking for mercy. Solomon gives him mercy. Solomon says, if you live as sort of a semi-exile, I will allow you to remain, be part of the family, and you know, I won't have you. We won't have to have a confrontation, which will probably result in one of us dying." So Donajai comes back later in this chapter and asks Bathsheba to ask Solomon if he can have Abishag, the young maiden we just talked about in the first part of the book, as his wife. And Solomon took that as an attempt to, again, undermine his own, Solomon's reign. Again, the strong thing for Adonijah was, you cannot undermine my reign. You must support what I'm doing. And that was taken as a very strong sign of undermining. And so he had Adonijah executed by his military guard. He also had Joab executed. This is where Joab meets his bitter end off of David's advice. And so the point of the first two chapters is Solomon sets up his reign. But again, it comes at the cost of another son of David. The nation of Israel is having a very hard time with peaceful transitions of power. Saul to David, now David to Solomon. And we're just having, you know, one thing you see in here is they're having a hard time with peaceful transitions to power, which is supposed to be one of the strengths of a hereditary monarchy that they wanted, but they're not realizing it. So let's go on. Chapter 3 and 4 talks about the administration of his kingdom. If you'll turn over to chapter 3, we'll start reading there. Solomon, verse 1, Solomon made an alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married his daughter. He brought her to the city of David until he finished building his palace and the temple of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. The people, however, were still sacrificing at the high places because a temple had not yet been built for the name of the Lord. Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to instructions given him by his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burned incense on the high places. The king went to Gibeon to offer sacrifices, for that was the most important high place. And Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon during the night in a dream. And God asked, and God said, "Ask for whatever you want me to give you." Solomon answered, "You have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart. You have continued this great kindness to him and have given him a son to sit on his throne this very day. Now, Lord my God, you've made your servant king in place of my father David. But I am only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you've chosen, a great number, too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours?" The Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. So God said to him, "Since you've asked for this and not for a long life or wealth for yourself, nor have asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I will do what you've asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart, so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Moreover, I will give you what you have not asked for, both wealth and honor, so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings. And if you walk in obedience to me and keep my decrees and commands as David your father did, I will give you a long life." Then Solomon awoke, and he realized it had been a dream. He returned to Jerusalem, stood before the ark of the Lord's covenant, and sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. Then he gave a feast for all his court. And so, most people think that he was about 20 years old when he became king. He was still a very young man. He was 20 years old, is what kind of the consensus of his age was. He's off to a great start. You know, he's asking for wisdom, and then God is responding. God is setting him up and setting the nation up for incredible splendor, as we'll read about. Then there's a story that illustrates his wisdom of the two. The Bible refers to them as prostitutes that were fighting over a child. And so, you know, that's the famous story we've heard where, you know, he made a ruling he said, divide the baby in half, knowing that the real mother would say, don't kill the baby, just let her have it. And he realized that that was whose child it was. And, you know, just a story like that demonstrating his wisdom and how he ruled. Let's turn to chapter 4. This goes through, and I think it's worth taking some time to read. This goes through the extent of his realm, of his splendor, the size of his bureaucracy. We're going to start in verse 20. The people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate, they drank, and they were happy. And Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates River to the land of the Philistines, as far as the border of Egypt. These countries brought tribute and were Solomon's subjects all his life. Solomon's daily provisions were 30 cores of the finest flour and 60 cores of meal, 10 head of stall-fed cattle, 20 of pasture-fed cattle, and 100 sheep and goats, as well as deer, gazelles, roebucks, and choice fowl. For he ruled over all the kingdoms west of the Euphrates River, from Tifsha to Gaza, and had peace on all sides. During Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, lived in safety, everyone under their own vine and under their own fig tree. The scale of these provisions describe a court of about 14,000 people. That's a lot of people. That's a lot, you know, for his size. That was a large court. He had a large central government doing a lot of things. This describes a peace dividend that David provided for him. David was the one who established the size of this kingdom, and he was able to benefit from the peace. God gave them the peace on all sides. It led to a prosperity unequaled amongst these people. Almost 500 years later, or 500 years earlier, were being removed from slavery in Egypt. They had reached the pinnacle of material prosperity. Solomon symbolized the best in education and learning and the best in material provision and comfort. And we'll pick up in verse 29. God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight, and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the people of the East, and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than anyone else, including Ethan the Ezrahite. I guess that must have been the modern-day version of Carl Sagan or somebody. Wiser than Heman, Calcol, and Darda. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they were pretty smart. The sons of Mahal. And his fame spread to all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. He spoke about plant life, from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of walls. He also spoke about animals and birds, reptiles and fish. From all nations, people came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. I mean, this guy, people were, you know, it was like he was the light on a hill, the light shining on a hill that people wanted to come and be a part of. Here's all these nations that David had conquered through force, and now they were bringing him tribute. He was probably a really good politician. He was probably a person that ruled. It talks about another passage we don't have a chance to read. People, how, you know, the Queen of Sheba said, how blessed your people must be to be living under your rule. How happy they were. And you could see the nations, let's see if I have the map next. No, I got it down later. But how happy they must have been to live there. Again, he symbolized the best in education and learning. Chapters 5 through 8. He made an alliance with Hiram of Tyre. David also had an alliance with this king, and then Solomon carried on. Hiram wound up being the material source for the building of the temple, the trees and stones. It goes into a lot of detail about the temple and the furnishings. There's an interlude in there to talk about him building his own palace, which consisted of three buildings, or four buildings, actually. There was the palace of the forest of Lebanon. It was called that because There were so many columns in it, and they all were basically from the cedar, from the trees from Lebanon. They called it the palace of, they called it the forest of Lebanon. I guess tongue in cheek. His own throne hall, the Hall of Justice, so he had a justice administration center. And then he had his own palace where he lived. And then he built a fourth palace next to that for Pharaoh's daughter. And then the ark, then it describes the ark was brought, and there was a prayer of dedication. It goes into great detail. All the timbers and the stones were built entire. You know, it's like it was architects who had been proud of this. They were already pre-built, pre-sized, designed, and they were made out entire and then brought in and constructed there. So there was very well organized. Probably would have been a very good project manager. He probably would have been a great architect. And then, as you'll see, over the ensuing weeks, this temple that they built would last 430 years before Nebuchadnezzar would destroy it and bring it to the ground. And so I have a picture here. The picture in the upper left is the tabernacle, or otherwise known as the tent of meetings, the tent of meeting. And that would give you an idea of what it looked like. That's where God was before the temple was built. That was how they worshiped from the beginning, from when they left with Moses. And this tent of meeting was what they used to do the altars. That was the accepted high place. And Alan will probably talk about this next week with the reign of Jeroboam. And talk about high places. It even alluded to it in the first passage you read, how Solomon worshipped, and they did worship in high places, which God does not seem to approve of. There seemed to be some provision for it before the temple was actually built. But this was supposed to be that where the tent of meeting was supposed to be the accepted place to do the sacrifices, and not to do them in other places. When the temple was built, it established it as a very strong law that they had to do the sacrifices at the temple. So when they got it built, that's where it was located. And then the final part of the synopsis of Solomon's reign is the Bible gives an overview of his legacy, which we're going to spend more time in. Let's turn to chapter 9. We're starting verse 1. When Solomon had finished building the temple of the Lord and the royal palace and achieved all he had desired to do, the Lord appeared to him a second time as he appeared to him at Gibeon. So here's the second appearance that God had made to Solomon. The Lord said to him, "I have heard the prayer and plea you have made before me. I have consecrated this temple which you have built. By putting my name there forever, my eyes and my heart will always be there. As for you, if you walk before me faithfully with integrity of heart and uprightness, as David your father did, and do all I command and observe my decrees and laws, I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father when I said, 'You shall never fail to have a successor on the throne of Israel. But if you or your descendants turn away from me and do not observe the commands and decrees I have given you and go off to serve other gods and worship them, and then I cut off Israel from the land I have given them and will reject this temple I have consecrated for my name, Israel will then become a byword and an object of ridicule among all peoples. This temple will become a heap of rubble. All who pass by will be appalled and will scoff and say, 'Why has the Lord done such a thing to this land and to this temple?' People will answer, 'Because they have forsaken the Lord their God, who brought their ancestors out of Egypt and have embraced other gods, worshiping and serving them. That is why the Lord brought all this disaster on them.'" So here it is now. The temple, Solomon's reign, you know, started, you know, and then the temple's kind of measured in about a 20-year period where his focus was building these projects, the temple and his palace, using the wealth that God had given him. So he's about 40 years old now, and here's a second vision or second dream that God has appeared to him. And this one, if you contrast it, it sounds a little more ominous, doesn't it? It's sort of like he says, hey, I'm here. It's almost like a warning prayer, I take it, you know. More so than the first prayer, which was like, I'm going to give you this stuff. I'm going to give you wisdom because I'm so pleased with you right now. I've given give you wisdom. I'm going to give you all this wealth. And now he's appeared to him again. And this prayer, I think, is significant to study and think about as we go on. And of course, you can see this. I think as we go through the class together, come back to this passage and the warnings that God gave Solomon to consider. Here we go. This is a map of. I wanted to go over this. This is a map of the extent of his kingdom. You can see the. You can see Edom, Moab, Ammon, Philistia, Aram. These were all the local the people that they were. They had really failed to drive out when during the era of the judges, but now they've been brought under control. And again, they're willingly going under Solomon's reign, probably just off the pure ability of Solomon to create great prosperity, and he had control of them. They actually had one of the things they talk about is they had a navy. That's the connection to the Red Sea. They had trade with Arabia and even some people think to India. So he had a lot of access to a lot of wealth. He was a man of great. David was a man of conquest. Solomon would be probably called a man of commerce. He was a great politician, as I said before. And now we're going to talk about God's, you know, weighing him on the standards that we talked about last week with David from Deuteronomy 17. He says, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. Again, you know, God had a vision for if you're going to have a king, I still want a king that reminds you of the patriarchal rule during the time of the judges. We're not going to build a big army. That's not what I want to see. And horses represent building a big army, something that could be used for offensive, you know, going out and conquesting. That's not what I visualize my people being in terms of how we're going to influence the world. We're not going to influence the world by going out and the way the rest of the world creates influence. Must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. We're going to talk about that here shortly. Must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. And again, Solomon did exactly the opposite of that in his reign. And keep his written scroll of Deuteronomy, Moses' sermon, and read it all the days of his life so he knows how to rule, which he would have read this stuff, and he would have said, where am I going? Do not consider himself better than his brothers. Do not turn from the law to the right or the left. And so there's the standards. And I highlighted, last week with David, I highlighted what I thought, you know, you can make an argument 5 and 6 he struggled with. I think Solomon struggled with all of them, as we see. We're going to turn to chapter 11 now. Let's see here. And as you see, my next slide, I just kind of isolate number 2. Because that seemed to be, as we read here, we'll find out why I did that. Chapter 1. Verse 1 of chapter 11, excuse me. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter. Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Moloch, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David his father had done. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Moloch, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives, who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, "Since this is your attitude, and you've not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen." So, as you can see here, it says Solomon had 700 wives. That's a lot of anniversaries. If you do the math, that's 1.8 anniversaries per day on average. I mean, and so it says that he held fast to them in love. There was obviously the political side of this, and we're going to talk about, you know, that reveals something about his character and something about how he did or did not trust God with the wealth that God had promised him. Obviously, a lot of these marriages were political to preserve the peace. Did he have to do it? Well, if he trusted God, he probably didn't have to. But this was a common practice of the nations around him, were to have political weddings. If you want peace with us, you've got to marry one of our princesses. That shows that you really accept us as a people and want to have, peace with us. And he probably compromised on that, even though God's law clearly said, don't do that. He compromised on that. And it obviously had disastrous consequences. Leviticus 20, verse 1 is worth a look. So if you want to turn over there, you can. I'm going to go ahead and turn over there and read it, because it's worth, in the short amount of time we have left, I think it speaks volumes on the depth of disobedience and the depth of challenge for this. Chapter 20 in Leviticus, verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, this is back to Moses, and again, he would know this, "Say to the Israelites, any Israelite or any foreigner residing in Israel who sacrifices any of his children to Moloch is to be put to death. The members of the community are to stone him. I myself will set my face against him and will cut him off from his people. For by sacrificing his children to Moloch, he has defiled my sanctuary and profaned my holy name. If the members of the community close their eyes when that man sacrifices one of his children to Moloch, and if they fail to put him to death, I myself will set my face against him and his family and will cut them off from their people together with all who follow him in prostituting themselves to Moloch." I mean, it's God usually just says, the person who does it, for most of the sins in there, the person who does it, that's the guy I'm going to take problem out on. But for this one's so grievous, sacrificing your own children, putting them to death in a religious exercise. That is so offensive to me. That defiles my name so greatly, my sanctuary so greatly, that if you know about it, Joe citizen, Joe fellow Israelite, and you don't do anything about it, I'm going to go after you. And according to the word, this was the kind of worship that Solomon was engaging in. It's hard to put a pretty face on this. It's hard to dress it up and say, Solomon, had a lot of splendor, but this is some bad stuff. There's no way to say it. We must, there's undoubtedly some of his children, probably with the wives that worship Moloch, I'm sure some of his children probably were put to death in this worship. So he started like a house of fire, but he limped home what I would call a polytheist. He was worshiping basically everybody. He still worshiped God. He probably wouldn't be called an apostate, even though his actions were, you know, probably symptomatic of total disobedience to what God wanted. But, because he still worshiped. He still would go and worship in the sanctuary. He still believed in Jehovah God. But he was also believing in all these other gods. To me, it's like a modern version of the person who says all roads lead to heaven. You know, it's just everybody, you know, everything I can do. And I think the key word that we hear out of Solomon that probably defined his character, unfortunately, in these last 20 years of his reign, he had a 40-year reign. The first 20 years, he kind of set himself to building the temple and the palace. The final 20 years, he really struggled and he with compromise. And that's something we can learn. You know, if I wanted to walk away with anything practically, it's like we shouldn't compromise. The world is always wanting us to compromise. The other thing I think we can learn is that, you know, in the spirit of, you know, past performance does not guarantee future results. You know, as an older person, this has been a sobering study for me to say, you know, I can see my heart, you know, falling back. You know, I can start off as a house of fire, as a young person. God wants us to be faithful all the way to the end. The real joy in our life is going to come from going all the way to the end. His legacy in the last few minutes, Nehemiah 13:26. He's quoted, he's referred to when they rebuilt the wall. When they rebuilt the wall, and what were they doing? They started intermarrying with the locals around them. And Nehemiah tore his hair, and they actually started forcing people to give up their foreign wives. Nehemiah 13:26, was it not because of marriages like these that Solomon, king of Israel, sinned? Among the many nations, there was no king like him. He was loved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. But even he was led into sin by foreign women. Proverbs 31:3, even the own book that he compiled of Proverbs, you know, maybe, I guess this is his contemporary, King Lemuel, had a proverb. It says, "Do not spend your strength on women, your vigor on those who ruin kings." Women truly ruined King Solomon. The foreign influences, the compromise. He was given much. He was a man of extremes. He had extreme wisdom. He had extreme plenty. He had extreme projects, and he had extreme indulgence. Being given all these things is no guarantee of future faith. Sometimes we think, I know I'm tempted to think, God, if you can make life a little easier, or if I could receive some desire of my heart, faith, I know, for me would be easier. Solomon serves as an example that is not necessarily true. So I'm going to conclude with Jesus' passage. And again, it talks about, you know, that was one of the legacies of Solomon, is, you know, we can sometimes think that all those things are great for us, but they're not necessarily, they're not a replacement for faith and the real value of our life. And he says in verse 28 of Matthew 6:28, Jesus is using Solomon as a teaching example that I want to conclude with. "And why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow? They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith?" So thank you for your attendance this morning in class. I hope there were some things that give you some things to think about and enhance your Bible study as you study these characters, the kings, who we can learn from. And at this point, we'll be dismissed, and we'll continue our worship service after we get our children and have some time of fellowship. Thank you.